Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Papal Appeal. Pope Benedict urges the international community to send aid to the victims of the tsunami and volcanic eruption in Indonesia and to those affected by floods in Benin. Sudan, ringing the alarm bells. We learn why Sudanese church leaders are worried about the risk of renewed war if the people in the south are unable to vote in a promised referendum on independence. Malawi, no longer begging. The African nation of Malawi is one of the few countries on the continent where the government has been able to meet most of the Millennium Development Goals, and we discover the reason behind their success. And blowing the whistle. 16 European football leagues dedicated their matches last weekend to the fight against hunger and poverty, with players, coaches and referees blowing whistles in a major media campaign spearheaded by the UN Food and Agricultural Organization. Benedict has appealed to the international community to come to the aid of the victims of the tsunami and volcanic eruption in Indonesia and to those affected by floods in Benin. His twin appeals came at the end of his Wednesday general audience. Emma McCarthy tells us more.
Pope Benedict XVI has called on the international community to quickly provide relief following a disastrous earthquake and tsunami in Indonesia and severe floods in Benin.
Ai familiari delle vittime esprimo il più vivo cordoglio.
In an appeal launched at the end of his general audience Wednesday, the Holy Father assured the people of Asia and Africa that he was praying for them and urged global donors to provide the necessary relief aid to alleviate the suffering of those affected by such devastation. One of Indonesia's most active volcanoes, Mount Merapi, erupted overnight Tuesday on Java Island, spewing out clouds of ash and jets of searing gas. The eruption came just one day after a tsunami triggered by an earthquake pounded remote islands in western Indonesia, leaving hundreds dead. Meanwhile, in the West African nation of Benin, weeks of flooding have killed around 60 people and forced over 120,000 to flee their homes. Seven people have died out of a total of 800 cases of cholera, while malaria, which thrives on waterlogged conditions, has also claimed lives.
Dear brothers and sisters,
earlier in his audience, attended by thousands in St. Peter's Square, Pope Benedict rapped warm against the autumnal chill in his red cape, said the role of women in the church is equally important, while not overlapping, as that of ordained priesthood for the spiritual growth of the community. Moreover, often they are the driving force and spiritual centre of the family, the domestic church. His reflections are part of his series of lessons dedicated to the great female figures of the Church in the Middle Ages, this week focusing on co-patron of Europe, St. Bridget of Sweden.
Born in 1303, she grew up steeped in the faith. She and her husband had 8 children and dedicated themselves with great fervor to the spiritual life and their children's Christian formation. Bridget was the driving force behind her and her husband's conjugal sanctity, and became a model for many women through the ages of how to be the spiritual center of the family.
Often called the mystic of the north, Bridget was a deeply cultured and a very practical woman, a humble but bold pilgrim, a counselor to the highest royalties of the time, and founder of the order which she dedicated to the Most Holy Savior.
Following her husband's death, in 1349, she made a pilgrimage to Rome to obtain papal approval for a religious order of both men and women, which he intended to found.
This, the Holy Father added in comments in Italian, is something that should not surprise us. There were monastic foundations in the Middle Ages with male and female branches, but which practiced the same monastic rule under the direction of an abbess. In fact, in the great Christian tradition, the dignity of women and their place in the church is recognized, and following the example of Mary, Queen of the Apostles, while not overlapping that of the ordained priesthood, they are equally important for the spiritual growth of the community.
Upon all of you, God's abundant blessings.
In his greetings to English-speaking pilgrims, Pope Benedict concluded with a special welcome to the Brigidine sisters, who, fittingly enough, are in Rome for the general chapter. I'm Emer McCarthy.
Sudanese leaders have warned of the risk of renewed war if the people in the south of Sudan are unable to vote in a promised referendum on independence. The warning comes amid serious delays in preparations for the vote, which is scheduled for January the 9th, as part of the 2005 peace agreement ending Sudan's long-running civil war between the north and the south. The church leaders fear that the referendum will be disputed, leading to renewed conflict, and urge the international community to be prepared in case this happens. One of the problems is that Sudan has not yet appointed a commission to organise a simultaneous referendum, promised under the same peace deal, on whether the disputed Abyei region should join North or South Sudan. An ecumenical delegation from Sudan, including several Catholic prelates and representatives from Caritas Internationalis, raised the alarm about the delays and the growing tensions in the lead-up to the referendum in a series of meetings held this month with the UN Secretary-General Ban Ki-moon and with political leaders from the US and Britain. One of the key members of that ecumenical delegation who met the UN Secretary-General in New York was Joseph Donnelly, the permanent delegate to the United Nations of Caritas Internationalis. I began by asking him how serious and real was the risk of renewed conflict in Sudan if the referendum doesn't go ahead on the planned date.
It's a very real risk, mostly because the Sudanese community has been waiting for 5 years for this sort of action, the referendum, the right to self-determination. So there's great suspicion that what would the reasons be at this late date to be delaying it after so much time for the preparations. Therefore, the community is just adamant that there will be a decision made on January 9th, one way or another. And the fear would be if it's violently opposed, it will result in considerable violence.
Because judging by the noises coming from the government in Khartoum, it does look as though a delay, at least as far as they're concerned, is increasingly likely.
Our understanding, having just discussed this with ecumenical religious leaders from the north and the south, is clear evidence that part of their alarm in communicating this message to the international community has been to say, perhaps inevitably, it will need more time. The preparations for the registration are slow, far behind, and don't even begin until November 14th. And only 7 days were allowed for the registration, which is a phenomenally inefficient process. 10 extra days were added, which would bring us to November 17th. But then it's roughly 2 months now, 2.5 months, till the referendum. So the fear is that there's a not just a logistical quagmire here, but a political strategy to delay it for reasons other than what is obvious and what has been promised to the community.
And what are the chief factors that have led to this delay, you know, the disputes between the two sides? What is it that's really holding up or slowing down this whole process?
I think it would be best to say from both sides, one is the urgent will to have the referendum, to have the right for self-determination for the suffering people in southern Sudan, and for those southerners who have lived, been caught or trapped, or by choice been somehow working in the north. The position on the other side would be that all things are possible, and this is the sort of roundout fulfillment of the CPA, Comprehensive Peace Agreement from 2005. But the issue would be if you've been planning this for 5 years, why in the last 90 days are we now saying, oh, we won't make the deadline?
Now, you were part of an ecumenical delegation that met earlier this month with the United Nations Secretary General. What kind of impression did you get? What kind of feedback did you get from the UN about how committed they are to this process going forward?
Great question. I think that the Catholic and Anglican bishops and others from the Sudanese Council of Churches, really the best thing to say is they alarmed the Secretary General and subsequently Member Security Council by their rather succinct statement of, here's the pieces, it doesn't add up logistically, so we also have a question politically, does everyone want this to happen? Are we all in the same place? The UN's response to that, I think, pleased to say, was clear attentiveness to what the church leaders raised as very practical, succinct comments on this won't happen if this doesn't happen, kind of the juxtaposition. And then the sense that this has been on the table for 5 years. So at this late stage to say, oh, we're not ready, oh, that maybe could happen, doesn't quite come off as genuine. And I'm happy to say that after 5 or 6 days of the delegation speaking to the members of the Security Council, to lots of the experts, several messages were released from the UN that confirm a sudden and increased realization of greater vulnerability on the ground, that the time frame will take longer, and that January 9th cannot be the exact day. And understandably, logistically and diplomatically, the UN is asking the bishops to help them prepare the community to accept the delay. And while the church leaders did not say we won't accept it, they did say, no, our fundamental role right now is to keep us on that date as an absolute and as a guarantee to the local community, both Christians and many Muslims who are caught up in this triangle of where do they belong now and where will they be safest, that's the first promise to the people, that it is the fundamental agreement is the protection of people.
And how much leverage does the UN have in this situation, in at least calling on the Khartoum government to, if they can't keep to the January the 9th referendum day, then at least to have it as soon as possible after that, that it stays on track?
I think that's another good question, and it's the whole business of mutual accountability. So what can we do together to ensure that the right thing happens? For the bishops, for Caritas on the ground, the big issue is what can we do together to ensure peace? So there is a pretty serious behind-the-scenes conversation, dialogue going on, both the government of South Sudan, the SPLM, and the government in Khartoum, to say we all know what the consequences could be if this is not handled transparently and quite aggressively in terms of delivering sooner rather than later. And I think the bishops have gone out of their way to absolutely underscore that for the average person who has been living in a less than free, self-determined situation for decades, how much more will they trust another date, another process? So I think the corporate opinion on this matter at this point is move forward, be transparent, and we feel that the UN has begun as a UN body, which doesn't control the situation, tries to add to via peacekeeping methods and diplomatic efforts to assure people that we are all on the same page and this must happen soon. The Secretary General's special representative for this crisis and for this referendum is an African ambassador named Halimin Karyos, and he is the fundamentally trusted person who's trying to deliver on a benefit for all sides and not prejudge the perhaps expected outcomes.
Presumably, there must be a massive amount of distrust on both sides, you know, given that these are two parts of a country that fought a bitter civil war for decades. And I imagine that is also not helping matters.
It isn't. And in a lot of these conflict zones in the world where we as Caritas try to play a role as a peace builder and really be a bridge between those sides, it is this distrust which is epic. And yet at the same time, perhaps paradoxically in some of these situations, people do see windows of opportunity. And sometimes when we can help accompany sides to that table, we actually become this bridge that holds it together so the moment does unfold. And that's very much why the bishops came on their advocacy mission to the UN, the UK, and the US to alert, but also to consolidate kinds of support, diplomatic, practical, pastoral, to say we have to really hold this as a common trust to get us all to that date and deliver something substantial.
Now, when you talk to people from the church from southern Sudan, I mean, what do they say about the mood of the people there in the lead up to this referendum?
Yeah, I would say that the church's voice on is the people feel it vulnerable. They use the word fear a great deal. But they also end up by saying there is a hope. There's enough of a common understanding of the investment that's been made to believe we could get there. That's part of why there's a reluctance in the church to say, give up January 9th. And the position is, much like other, I suppose, controversial crisis management moments, is to say, no, maybe we will get to January 12th. But we're not going to say that until January 9th, because that is, albeit a sacred date in the minds and the hearts of the people, who would feel that the getting to the referendum should have happened on January 9th, 2006, 5 years ago, when the CPA agreement was signed. So that's where the deepest distrust is. And so we're facing the fact today in a very alarming way, because the shocking news is that the vulnerability that's felt on the ground, perhaps the buildup of distrust, and then the retaliation and even some recent incidents with armed soldiers have intimidated people who were thinking we had passed that stage. So on both sides is already edging as a robust readiness to fight that doesn't speak well for those who are begging for peace.
Turning to Khartoum, do you get the impression there that the Sudanese government is prepared to honour its promise, that there's not a risk that it might try to wriggle out of this promise of the referendum, given that it's expected almost certainly to lead to an overwhelming vote for independence? They're going to lose a chunk of their territory, in effect?
I think that there is a sense, both from the UN interlocutors and from the religious leaders, that the Khartoum will honor it is not altogether questioned. The fear factor is how long and in what ways will they respond as it processes itself out, recognizing, as you say, that there will be a loss of territory here. The other part of it is that there's the north, there's the south, and then there's the Abyei peace in the middle, the
oil-producing
rich region, which could go north, could go south. And those people have a referendum themselves. So there's two referenda the same day. So the possibility of convoluting sort of who's on first and what's next is very confusing to local people. Hence, the absolute fear factor of will what we hope for happen versus what maybe some political governmental people will negotiate on a sideline. And that's, again, another source of anxiety.
Okay, turning from politics to humanitarian affairs, how would you describe the humanitarian situation in Sudan at the moment? And what role is Caritas playing there in trying to alleviate hunger and poverty and bring about adherence to the Millennium Development Goals?
We are exceedingly present. You know, the best way Caritas does its work is simply to walk with the people who are our brothers and sisters in every place. So the needs vary. We are involved in Darfur. We're involved in North and South Sudan in different ways through local Caritas communities anywhere else in the world. Concerns are huge about food and hunger. Concerns are really huge about security and being rooted in one's community. So if the referendum creates an instability, we are a part of the conversation right now about contingency plans for humanitarian assistance, what might be needed, where, when, and also the very practical things of how do you get humanitarian staff in if there's this insecurity in the country or vulnerability at that given moment. So we are trying to approach it from both sides simultaneously. And in that sense, sometimes we have to be the leaven on the peace building side when the vulnerability is so high. But I think the very fact that Caritas, CAFOD, CRS, any number of major Catholic organizations are in there along with many Protestant organizations is, and we hear this from the people, kind of the encouragement that you haven't left us, so you have some hope and you'll be here when we pass through. And that's very much the hope of the international community, who absolutely are asking the church leaders to be this voice for peace and stability while recognizing we're walking a very rough road.
Okay, you said it's a very rough road. And if the worst case scenario came to pass, you mentioned, you know, these vulnerabilities, these fears, if the peace agreement unravels and the country were to slide back into civil war, what then?
My first reaction is to say, God help us. The reaction, the concern of the bishops, but also of many humanitarian experts and UN experts is the violence could be worse than what they have seen in the past. So if we know that in the past we've had 2 million people dead, 4 million displaced, 600,000 gone refugees in other places, the concern, which is important to note, is that there'll be also an epic regional impact.
I was talking to Joseph Donnelly of Caritas Internationalis. How often do we hear depressing stories about African and other developing nations who are failing in their bid to meet the Millennium Development Goals to reduce poverty and hunger? In fact, not only are many of these nations in Africa failing to meet the Millennium Goals, but in some cases their situation has become even worse in recent years, partly as a result of the global financial crisis. So, it's always heartwarming and inspirational to learn about a success story on the African continent, a developing country where life is improving for its population. And this particular story comes from the tiny and impoverished nation of Malawi. Situated in East Africa, Malawi was until recently unable to grow enough food to feed its people, but after agricultural policy change, now has a food surplus and has managed to meet 5 out of the 8 Millennium Goals over the past 2 years. Peter Mwanza is Malawi's Minister for Agriculture and Food Security, and he recently attended an international Prayer for Peace meeting organised by the Sant'Egidio Catholic Lay Group in Barcelona. At that meeting, the minister told us how Malawi has been transformed from a nation where the government was forced to beg the international community for food aid each year into one with a healthy food surplus.
Well, the secret is simple. You know, Malawi, first of all, Malawi used to be a very poor country. It used to lack food. Every year, we used to go out of the country to beg for food aid. That was the situation, and there were times when the food aid would arrive late, and that would really be terrible for the population. So when our present president, Ngwazi Professor Bingu wa Mutharika, took power in 2004, he felt it was very undignified and very embarrassing, and he resolved, and he mobilized all of us, he resolved that Malawi should not be going outside to beg for food. And from that time we said we are going to have our own agricultural development that will make sure that, you know, Malawi is not a food insufficient country, but it's a food surplus country.
Mwanza says by taking the decision to subsidize poor farmers, the government of Malawi has dramatically transformed the food security situation in his homeland.
Most of the farmers in Malawi, 85% of the Malawians are rural people. These are the people who produce the foodstuff. And they are small and poor. They cannot produce a good crop without fertilizer. The fertilizer is expensive for the poor person. So the government decided, led by the president, that we have to subsidize these poor farmers. And this did a trick. They still bought the fertilizer, but at a reduced price. And the results were outstanding and astounding because there was a big surplus. And since that time, we have resolved that, you know, yes, for the poor farmers to be able to perform, they need to be assisted.
He says as a result of these policy changes, Malawi is now in a position to help others. And as a case in point, was able to ship rice to Haiti after the devastating earthquake there at the beginning of this year.
We are now at the level when we're exporting food, and we're also even giving aid to those countries which are in difficulties. You know, this year, when we heard about the earthquake in Haiti, you know, Malawi was able to donate 200 metric tons of rice, just like that. Yeah. So as a result of that, there is a sense of pride in every Malawian that you are able to stand alone without going to beg for food.
Minister Mwanza also spoke about the important role of the churches in Malawi and how cooperation between the government and religious organisations is vital in this regard.
Religion in Africa has always played a very, very important role. It has played a very important role in education. Most of the schools before long were church schools. They were religious schools. I was educated in a Catholic, you know, school from primary to university. The religion has also provided hospitals, for example. In fact, actually, you could say that probably the majority of the hospitals in my country are run by churches. But not only that, the religion now is playing a role in more than that. They have programs, for example, providing clean water, potable water for drinking, providing boreholes, they're also providing piped water. They have also gone into rural areas to help with actually the whole development process in terms of actually assisting in agricultural development.
That was Malawi's agricultural minister, Peter Mwanza, interviewed by Vatican Radio's Luca Attanasio. There was a lot of whistleblowing last weekend on professional football pitches across Europe. But on this occasion, those blowing a whistle were not just the referees, but also the players and coaches. They were all taking part in the European Match Day Against Hunger, where a total of 16 football leagues across the continent dedicated their matches to the fight against chronic poverty and hunger in our world. The football leagues also urged their millions of fans to sign an online petition calling on governments to give priority to the elimination of hunger. The head of the European Professional Football Leagues Association, or EPFL, said the fight against hunger was the moral duty of our generation and the challenge of our civilization. The Match Day for Hunger was promoted by both the EPFL and the UN Food and Agricultural Organization, or FAO. Paul Antham is a communications officer at FAO, and he told Lydia O'Kane more about the initiative.
This initiative came about after FAO signed an agreement with the European Professional Football Leagues Association in 2008, and the aim of this is to tap into the power and immense popularity of sport, and in particular football, and the fact that millions of people attend stadia across Europe each weekend. We're going to tap into that huge popularity to highlight the fact that 925 million people are chronically hungry across the world, and the fact that this is totally unacceptable.
How helpful has the European Professional Football Leagues Association been with this?
Extremely helpful. Since we've signed the deal, we've had visits from representatives. We've also struck a separate deal with Atletico Madrid, and we had a visit from their star goalkeeper, David De Gea, earlier this year. And all the players have come on board. They've also made videos that are now appearing on YouTube, highlighting the weekend and highlighting the issues. And really, this has been a great opportunity. And a lot of the players, actually, with some of the bad publicity there is for footballers, there's actually been a positive light from the footballers that isn't often covered. In fact, recognising how fortunate they are in their lives and how fortunate they are not only with their incomes and the jobs that they do, but also the profile they have and the opportunity to actually highlight something that is not that well known across the world, i.e. the amount of people who are living in extreme poverty and don't have enough food on the table for their families.
That was Paul Antham of FAO speaking to Lydia O'Kane. Well, that's all for today from me, Susie Hodges, here at Vatican Radio's English programme. But we'll be on the air again at the same time tomorrow. And you can always find our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.